Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Same-sex marriage makes headlines again this week across the country and in Appalachia.
We believe that the people of Kentucky, through their elected lawmakers, ought to control marriage policy.
An outdoor classroom in Virginia addresses watershed issues.
There was an old bridge abutment down by the stream.
Tourism professionals at a conference in Charleston, West Virginia, are not worried about the water.
All of the hotels, the restaurants, the convention center that we're and the places that we're going use filtered water.
And Traveling 219 makes another visit to the Tigard Valley Homestead in Randolph County, West Virginia.
But I didn't realize that there was any historical reference to our communities.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. An Exxon Valdez worth of oil is now shipped on the rails every day in the United States. In the middle of a fracking boom, trains have become a necessary way to get oil from drilling hotbeds to markets. But accidents like the one that caused a spill of Canadian crude oil near Pittsburgh recently are on the rise. As the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports, so are questions about the safety of shipping oil by rail.
From his living room in North Vandergrift, Pennsylvania, Rob Smeltzer likes to watch the trains roll by across the river.
My couch, I can look right out the window and see the train.
The train runs on a Norfolk Southern rail line along the Kiskaminetus River. Smeltzer says he's noticed a change in the types of cars that run on the rail line these days.
There seem to be more tankers today than what there was maybe 3 or 4 years ago.
One morning last week, he was in his living room when he heard a loud noise. He knew immediately what had happened.
Banging and clanging and rattling, the trucks leaving the tracks.
The sounds came from a Norfolk Southern train carrying oil and liquefied natural gas, leaving the tracks. About 4,000 gallons of crude oil spilled in the parking lot of an industrial building near the train tracks. Federal investigators are still trying to find out what caused the derailment. It was the latest in a series of accidents involving the shipment of crude oil on trains. According to a report from McClatchy Newspapers, more oil was spilled in rail accidents in the U.S. in 2013 than the previous four decades combined. So why are all these oil train accidents happening?
Because we have a lot more oil trains running around.
Alan Zaremski is director of the Railroad Safety and Engineering Program at the University of Delaware. He says there simply aren't enough pipelines to transport oil from drilling hotspots like North Dakota and Alberta, Canada.
It takes 10 years to build a pipeline, 10 years plus sometimes to build a pipeline, and so going by rail is a very good option.
Crude shipments by rail have jumped over 4,000% since 2008, and with an increase in traffic, there are more spills. Though Zaremski says the rate of rail accidents in the U.S. is actually declining.
The safety record of the railway industry is still extremely good, but is it risk-free? No, there is a risk.
Though the oil spilled in western Pennsylvania came from Canada, much of the oil carried on the rails these days is fracked out of the ground in North Dakota's Bakken Formation. Regulators now suspect that this North Dakota crude oil is more explosive than other kinds of crude. This makes rail accidents involving North Dakota oil more dangerous.
That's what everybody seems to think what happened in the Quebec derailment.
In that case, an oil train carrying North Dakota crude derailed and exploded in a resort town in Quebec last summer. The accident killed 47 people and burned dozens of buildings. This and other accidents have led to a focus on the tank cars used to transport oil. Patty Riley is with the American Association of Railroads.
There are a lot of tank cars out there today moving flammable liquids that need to either be retrofitted or phased out.
Riley says that's why the industry is voluntarily phasing out older tankers in favor of stronger, more puncture-proof rail cars. But environmental groups like the Sierra Club say this can't happen fast enough. They want the U.S. Department of Transportation to immediately take older rail cars off the tracks. Another recommendation is to reroute trains carrying oil away from cities and other population centers. But Zaremski of the University of Delaware says keeping oil entirely away from cities isn't all that likely either.
Sometimes you're dealing with refineries that are located at or near the population centers themselves.
Some analysts suggest these oil train accidents could push the Obama administration to approve the Keystone XL pipeline that would bring crude oil in from Canada's tar sands to the U.S. But as rail advocates like to point out, pipelines can also have spills. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. You can find more at AlleghenyFront.org. Two federal judges issued rulings on same-sex marriage this past week. A judge in Texas declared that state's ban unconstitutional, and another in Kentucky ruled the state must recognize same-sex marriages performed in other states. In Kentucky, both sides in the debate are reacting after Judge John Hayburn in Louisville signed the final order, meaning his February 12th decision recognizing out-of-state same-sex marriages is now law. Attorney General Jack Conway has requested a 90-day stay so he can have more time to decide if the state wants to appeal. Martin Cothran with the Family Foundation of Kentucky says the 2004 constitutional amendment banning gay marriage in the state represents the will of the people.
We believe that the people of Kentucky, through their elected lawmakers, ought to control marriage policy in our state. That's our prerogative. As soon as you give on this issue, what you've done is you've ceded your authority over that issue to other states. Well, we think that if the Attorney General is going to fight for this, then he ought to do it, and he ought to do it well. He hasn't done that so far. If he's not going to fight for it, then he needs to be honest with the voters and tell them he's not going to defend their rights.
But some, including a Lexington couple, are celebrating the judge's ruling. Ross Ewing has been with his partner for 8 years. The couple had planned to marry this summer in New York.
By happy coincidence, we are still planning on being in New York the first weekend in June, which is our anniversary. My partner sings in Lexington Singers, and they're performing in Carnegie Hall that weekend, and we were just going to get married while we were up there.
Now, Ewing says the couple is thinking about waiting a little longer for the opportunity to get married in their home state. With this final ruling, Ewing believes it's only a matter of time before Kentucky fully legalizes same-sex marriage. Proponents of same-sex marriage have made headway in recent years, with some states granting the right to marry while others have been forced to recognize those unions. West Virginia University Chief Diversity Officer David Friesen offers these thoughts on this often divisive issue.
America needs a new level of engagement. So much of our dialogue is rooted in complex historic situations that require the most strident voices possible to expand our liberties to everyone. Perhaps the next step of our national dialogue needs to be the idea of meeting somewhere in the middle. Unfortunately, the word reconciliation has little place in our national conversation. Our focus should be on how we can coexist, even when a person or a group's core values seem to be in contradiction to the expansion of individual rights. This is particularly true as it concerns a person's religious beliefs. The transformative power of love and the word can move a cooperative agenda forward, but the belief of others must always be considered and valued. The challenge is to develop a dialogue that includes all facets of our community. For instance, in the movement for civil rights for the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community, conservative religions are often marginalized or completely left out of the conversation. As the movement for full rights for this community has gained momentum, it should not be taken for granted that conservative religious beliefs are inconsistent with the move for secular personal liberties for members of the LGBT community. Religious conservatives who oppose extending rights to the LGBT community often base their opposition upon religious conviction. Many have heartfelt core belief that it is wrong, i.e. sinful, for persons to engage in same-sex relationships. A new level of engagement will help to reconcile these types of religious beliefs that advocate against the extension of marriage to same-sex couples while maintaining the secular rights of the LGBT community. Conservative religions have a right to their teachings, however conservative, and any consideration of societal change must be cognizant of the religious freedoms of those who disagree. One reason it is so difficult for many conservative Christians to engage in the conversation regarding LGBT equality is the belief that any compromise in this regard will open the door for these relationships to be forced upon the church. For instance, many believe that if marriage equality becomes a law, these same conservative churches will be mandated at some point to perform religious ceremonies for same-sex couples, regardless of the religious beliefs of the church. There's been little attention made to address these types of sincere concerns. This issue is rooted in America's failure to embrace the doctrine of the separation of church and state. You see, so often when we think of this wall of separation between the church and the state, we consider this doctrine as a protection for the state against the reach of the church. In reality, the protection is most importantly a protection for the church against intrusion by the state. Historically, marriage has two components, a civil law element, and for those who exercise religious beliefs, a religious ceremony. In America, these two components have unfortunately morphed together. This separation needs to be reconsidered and reinstituted. We should implement the civil component for all marriages and separate this from the religious aspect. This frees up any religious organization to have its own authority on who it will marry while allowing the civil component to be completed by the state. This will help relieve the fear that a church or other religious organization would be forced to perform ceremonies against its very core beliefs. It will also allow religious conservatives to openly advocate their view without state intrusion. Many European countries recognize this type of distinction and are not experiencing our level of societal tension in regards to marriage equality. This is not really a compromise. It is a reality of living in a pluralistic society, which means our laws should be respectful of differing beliefs. We must regain the ability to speak to one another from the middle. Reconciliation can help us walk together as a pluralistic society without intruding upon one another's core beliefs.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Water donations from across the country have poured into Wyoming County since West Virginia Public Radio's Jessica Lilly first reported on problems with the water system there. Months before the chemical spill that tainted drinking water in Charleston, folks in Bud and Alpoca were dealing with unpotable water, running a dark brown at times. Another donation arrived at Herndon Consolidated School this past week, but as Lily reports, this particular donation was special.
January 9th, a chemical spill contaminated the water source for more than 300,000 customers in West Virginia's capital city and the surrounding area. A state of emergency was declared, the National Guard was called in to assist with water distribution, and donations arrived from groups across the country. Around that same time, Sarah Haymond was teaching a lesson to her third grade class at Blackshear Elementary in Marion County. Haymond decided the best way to teach about community service was to coordinate a water drive for the folks affected by the chemical spill.
We had a bunch of snow days, and I came back and I started worrying, like, the need for that water wasn't as great. And I wanted it to be something that the kids would be excited about, you know, and really feel like they were doing something good. So I started looking up on the internet, different areas in West Virginia that might need water, and I found the town of Bud.
The state of emergency is still in effect for 9 counties. But for the folks in Bud and Alpoca, about 500 people have been on a boil water advisory since September, and it's not a state of emergency. The Alpoca waterworks system is dated and without an operator. The owner is working to turn the utility over to the Eastern Wyoming County PSD, but it's not a simple sale. While the deal is worked out, residents seem to be caught in the middle, purchasing water for things like drinking, laundry, and cooking for about 6 months.
So I showed the students in my class the pictures that I found on the internet from the sinks and the waters, and they couldn't believe it. I mean, for little kids, it's, you know, it's just something they don't think about, you know, not having water. So they were real excited, and they started to bring in more water after that, and now they fully grasp, you know, what it means to do a community service project and what community service is.
The third graders collected about 65 to 70 gallons of water. The shipment arrived at Herndon Consolidated School on Tuesday. The school has served as a central drop-off place for donations and residents to find relief.
We use water in so many ways. Everybody needs water to live. The average body is made of 65% water. A kid my age needs 8 to 12 cups of water a day. We need water to cook our food and to drink.
That's Mackenzie Flew-Hardy. She's one of several Blackshear Elementary third grade students that contributed to the Budwater Drive. She's reading from a report that explains the lessons she's learned from the project.
Water is also needed to brush our teeth and take showers. Washing clothes and dishes would be an impossible task without water. Water is very important to me. I can't imagine life without water. I can't imagine going to school without taking a shower. I would feel greasy and dirty. I feel sorry for all the people that were affected in the town of Bud. Thinking about how this may have affected them makes me appreciate water a lot more. I think people need to use the water they have wisely. People take advantage of water and don't understand how important it really is. People should finish drinking what they have before getting more. They should also try to take shorter showers. What would you do if you lost water? Try to remember how important it is. As you take a shower, cook dinner, or just grab a glass of water, think about what life would be like without water. So if you have water that is sealed, please send it into the people that don't. It will help people make you feel like a hero.
Mackenzie Flew-Hardy is a West Virginia water hero, sending relief to the folks of Bud. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly in Athens.
Abandoned coal tipples and other buildings left behind from old coal operations are common sights throughout Central Appalachia, but one Southwest Virginia community has come together to transform what was a crumbling lot of buildings into something vibrant and new, an outdoor classroom and public park. The effort was spearheaded by the Upper Tennessee River Roundtable, a nonprofit community group that addresses water issues throughout Southwest Virginia. In the process of creating the classroom, the roundtable and a large group of partners encountered and addressed many water issues that had been caused by the old tipple. And as WMMT's Parker Hobson reports, they feel they've created something that not just helps the watershed, but will be a unique educational resource for local students.
There's a small triangular spur of flat land right off the main highway near St. Charles, Virginia, squeezed between the road, a steep wooded hillside, and Straight Creek, which flows into the North Fork of the Powell River. The plot might just be an acre and a half in size, but as AmeriCorps Vista volunteer Katie Comender told me on a recent winter afternoon, a remarkable transformation is taking place there.
Well, there's blueberries all in here, and black raspberries, American persimmons, and some plum trees. We have American hazelnut. We have pawpaw trees, like I mentioned, elderberries. And, you know, some of the species, like elderberry, for instance, those will produce fruit. But some of the other species we have in here, like buttonbush and silky dogwood, they won't. But, I mean, they'll be pretty and they'll look nice for the park.
We were in a field of freshly planted trees and shrubs, where around us, students and community volunteers were at work planting more, putting the finishing touches on the brand new Stone Creek Outdoor Classroom, which will open officially this spring. Just a few years ago, though, this property looked about as different as it possibly could. For decades, an old abandoned coal tipple complex of buildings and equipment sat here unused and falling apart. Bruce Miles is a retired expert in mine reclamation, and he has been a part of the transformation effort.
It was history, though, you know, the tipple and the coal industry and all, but it was also a problem, an eyesore, and it was a hazard, too, because they were some old buildings, old structures that people could get hurt, injured.
coal tipple sites, transfer stations, they were throughout this region. That's how, you know, they would get the coal down from the mountains and they would meet the train here and they would load it on.
Nicole Vashon-Hanlon works for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and she's been involved with this project since the initial discussions took place in the mid-2000s. She said to make this work, it's taken the cooperation of a lot of different partners with the same vision.
So I'm sure there's other tipple sites throughout here, but this was one that was a very visible site. The owners were approached to purchase it, and it was a lot of partners, the Powell River Partnership with Daniel Boone Soil and Water Conservation District and DMME, like I mentioned. They all like kind of worked together to try to say, we could make this better.
Because this site was not eligible for cleanup funding under the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, it was up to a private group to lead the effort. So the Upper Tennessee River Roundtable, or UTRR for short, got involved. UTRR is a nonprofit community group that addresses water issues throughout Southwest Virginia, and they partnered with a broad group of private and governmental agencies to buy the property, tear the old buildings down, and convert the space into an outdoor classroom and public park. The classroom will serve as an interactive setting for student groups of all ages to learn about scientific and environmental issues, especially those specific to Central Appalachia. But before it could be fit for students, UTRR Director Carol Doss told me there was a lot of cleaning up to do.
When we actually got, we bought the land, it had, yeah, it still had the office building, it still had all this old metal pieces, loading and unloading equipment. And plus, it hadn't been used for years, so a lot of things had fallen over, and there was an old bridge abutment down by the stream, an old fence, you know, just a variety of stuff. There was even coal here still. When we got it, it was just, yeah, kind of cluttered.
Aside from just being an eyesore, there were several ways in which the old tipple was harming the environment, particularly the creek and the watershed. Because they were building a classroom, they addressed these problems as they worked, in order to show future student groups both common water issues and possible solutions. One of the more serious issues they encountered came from part of an old bridge that had been left in the creek and was causing serious erosion of the stream bank, which in turn was causing high levels of sedimentation to flow into the water. Heavy sedimentation in streams can contribute to a number of problems, including flooding and making the water more difficult to treat for drinking. As Nicole told me, it can also choke out aquatic life.
Sediment is one of the biggest pollutants that we have for the streams right now. It's natural in a stream system, but when you have too much, it can cause problems for filling in. It changes the hydrology, but it also affects the habitat for the fish and for the macroinvertebrates that live in the water that the fish eat. So if you like to fish, you need those macroinvertebrates too, like dragonfly nymphs and damselfly nymphs. And there was a lot of deposition sedimenting into the stream from where that abutment was, and it was all bare bank.
So they hauled off the old bridge and rebuilt the stream bank from the 90 degrees to which it had eroded into a more gradual slope. To help hold the dirt in, they terraced the new bank, stuffed it with old tree roots, and covered it in biodegradable netting. To strengthen the bank even further, they planted what is known as a riparian buffer on top, vegetation that will create roots to help hold the bank in place.
And on the top layer here, we have these students helping us to plant pawpaw trees and persimmon. And then we also have some other plants that are along throughout this corridor, the riparian corridor along the stream. Hazelnuts, persimmon, pawpaw, elderberry, witch hazel. All of these things on the buffer and the stream restoration are all meant to help stabilize the bank so we have less erosion going into the stream.
They could have used any kind of vegetation to hold the stream bank together, but thanks to a partnership with a nonprofit called Appalachian Sustainable Development, they were able to use non-timber plants that were either edible or had other uses. Katie Comender has worked on this part of the classroom, and she told me that in addition to providing free food access for wildlife and community members, they also hoped to set an example for a way that landowners with streams on their property might be able to protect the water supply and possibly even make some extra money at the same time.
The non-timber forest product riparian buffers benefit the environment because they're reducing pollution from entering the creek, they're providing wildlife habitat and food, they're reducing sediment erosion from the stream bank. They're doing all these great environmental things, but because they're edible products or medicinal products, for instance, that can be harvested and sold, it's also an economic benefit to the landowner. So in my mind, economic incentives and environmental incentives and benefits can totally merge. And when they do, I mean, that's the whole beauty of this project. I think that's why it makes it work.
They addressed other environmental problems at the site, too. To help filter runoff, they built a small-scale wetland on the property and installed permeable walking paths and parking surfaces. And to cover asbestos and other contaminants left from the old buildings, they brought in 2 feet of brand new topsoil. But as Carol and Nicole told me, just addressing environmental issues is one thing, but the heart of this project lies in being able to share these solutions with the community and to create a space that all can enjoy. Particularly, the classroom hopes to engage local students in environmental issues in an exciting, hands-on way.
Kids, you know, they just learn, I think, really well outside. You know, just experiencing nature, getting out, doing something different than just sitting in a classroom all the time. Even if it's just one day, you know, every now and then. It just seems like it's really, if you go to a place like this and you learn about nature, you just start connecting.
I mean, I think when you bring them out, then they gain understanding. As I'm teaching them about the stream bank, putting the fabric down, I'm explaining why we're retaining the sediment so that we have better water quality, because you might want to fish, or somebody you know might want to fish, you know, like making it really relevant. I think it's great that these young people are here today because one of the challenges when you create an outdoor classroom, park, recreation space is that you want the people who are going to use it to be involved. And so each of the young people are planting at least one tree so that they can come back and that's their tree, that they can come back and see how it's growing. And I think taking ownership of a place is really important.
The students I met who were out volunteering their time to help create the classroom all seemed to embody the hopes Carol, Nicole, and everyone involved had for the space. They had fun, learned some things, and are excited to come back. Hannah Allen is a local high school student.
I had a lot of fun. I learned how to plant the living stakes and put them in the ground and how to make sure the trees grow.
Yeah, I lived in Keokuk since I was born and raised, so I passed through here about every day when I had to come to town.
Madison Pennington was another student out planting trees.
Just broken down, hadn't been used in years, and now it looks like it's changed a whole lot since last time.
Madison told me she wants to keep coming back to volunteer at the outdoor classroom because she feels like it's a positive thing for the community.
Well, there's not many places around here for families to get together that's safe, and anybody could have come in here and got hurt, and this is a good place for people to come to get out of the house instead of sitting in the house all the time and actually doing something together, working together.
Carol thinks Madison is right. As communities throughout the mountains try to find ways to deal with declining economies and populations, projects like this one that create spaces where people can come together could help improve the quality of life for people in mountain towns and might even help bring new blood to the region.
But as far as, yeah, keeping people here, bringing people here, you've got to have something for people to do. You know, this is a place people can go, be outside, enjoy it. So I think it is helping. I would hope so.
Tim Miles works with the Daniel Boone Soil and Water Conservation District, a state group that has partnered with UTRR on the Stone Creek Classroom. He also lives nearby and thinks the project could provide an example for how other communities in the region could deal with abandoned sites like this one.
When people work together in different groups, that, you know, what is like a hazard or like an area that sort of seems abandoned or somewhat unused, you know, it can be, you know, once properly addressed or, you know, even with a lot of creativity, you know, can be made into something, you know, that could be appreciated and, you know, help benefit the area.
The site won't officially open until the springtime, but Bruce Miles and everyone else I met felt that regardless of how many students are able to come and learn, or how many community members end up using the park, the project has already done a world of good.
Well, as a friend up the road here said one day, he said, "You really made that place look good." So I remember what it used to look like. And he said it's been improved 100%. I'd say that they were glad to see it gone.
For more on the work of the Upper Tennessee River Roundtable, you can find them on Facebook or at upperTNRiver.org. For more on the Stone Creek Outdoor Classroom, you can visit our website, WMMT.org, for links and photos. Reporting for WMMT, I'm Parker Hobson.
Staff at Mammoth Cave National Park in South Central Kentucky say a fatal bat disease has now shown up in visitor passageways. The disease was found in remote sections of the cave system last year. Rick Toomey, a scientist with the Resource Management Division at the park, says humans are not at risk.
The reason is the bats are being infected when their body temperatures are down around freezing, and their immune system is turned off, which happens in hibernation. Since people never get body temperatures down that low, the fungus won't grow on people.
Toomey says measures are being taken to stop the fungus from leaving the park.
Every visitor walks over a biocontrol mat after their tour that will hopefully clean their shoes off and keep them from potentially accidentally moving those fungal spores to someplace else.
There are no plans to alter tours or research at Mammoth Cave. White nose syndrome first showed up in the U.S. in 2005 and has killed about 7 million cave-dwelling bats. The first reported case in Kentucky was 2 years ago in Trigg County. The National Park Service announced more than $500,000 in grants from the Land and Water Conservation Fund to help preserve more than 120 acres at four of America's threatened Civil War battlefields. The grants will allow preservation of 102 acres at Mill Springs Battlefield in Kentucky, more than 5 acres at Bentonville Battlefield in North Carolina, and in Virginia, nearly 4 acres at Appomattox Courthouse and 10 acres at Aldi Battlefield. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. An organization that promotes tourism in the Southeast, Travel South, just had its big annual conference in Charleston, West Virginia, 7 weeks after a chemical spill tainted the drinking water. West Virginia Public Radio's Dave Mistich stopped by the conference to see how tourism professionals from across the country view the water crisis and whether they think it will affect tourism in the state.
To host the conference, we had worked on this for 18 months, and we really felt comfortable, quite honestly, that the group would not start seeing cancellations.
Given the circumstances surrounding the chemical spill and water crisis, West Virginia Division of Tourism Commissioner Betty Carver says she reached out to other organizers of the conference to gauge whether or not participants would actually show.
I actually reached out to Liz, the director of Travel South, and my counterpart, Lee Sintel, in Alabama, the Monday after our water issue.
Travel South Executive Director Liz Bittner says she's helped cities and states bounce back after disasters, like the BP oil spill into the Gulf Coast in 2010. Bittner says conference participants didn't express any concerns over the water while in Charleston.
I haven't heard anything from any of my delegates' concerns about the water. Again, you know, we're focused on driving economic development and economic tourism and the business that at hand. All of the hotels, the restaurants, the convention center that we're and the places that we're going use filtered water. They've been tested. It's been cleared by the CDC. And so it's really been a non-issue.
As for the conference itself, hundreds of representatives from 11 states showcased their opportunities to potential travel operators. It's sort of like the tourism industry's version of speed dating.
You are
city tours or any of the prefams?
I've done a lot of driving around
awesome.
On my own.
Awesome.
I'm over at the Four Points.
Okay.
And they couldn't be nicer over
Wonderful.
There.
Wonderful. I've heard great things so far. That is fantastic.
Yeah. Actually, one of my bags didn't make it.
Group sales manager Lauren Hunt of the Charleston Convention and Visitors Bureau sat down with general manager of Cars Holidays from upstate New York, Michael Guidi.
New events, new things to do. A lot of them are musical groups. So always looking for performance venues, things like that.
Guidi's company is looking for destinations to take travel groups from his area, like high school marching bands, to different locations around the United States. Strangely enough, though, he didn't seem concerned with the water in Charleston or even how it might affect his business. In fact, he didn't bring it up until I asked him.
And if you would sort of tell me, and one of the things I noticed about your little conversation with the Charleston CBB is no mention of the water thing that happened here. Any particular reason you didn't bring it up or any concern on your part?
No, not really. Other people have addressed it. So, I mean, for me, it'll be future trips anyway. But, trips that'll come won't happen for another year or so. So hopefully it's all addressed by then.
And before you came here, did you have any sort of worry about the situation and what you'd seen on national coverage of it?
A little bit, but, it seems to have been handled. When I checked into the hotel, they were great about it, explained everything. So no fears, no worries.
And would you say that? As for Lauren Hunt of the Charleston CVB, well, she says Guidi's take on Charleston's water is representative of almost all of the operators and travel writers with whom she had met, with one exception.
Actually, I've only had one appointment that's even mentioned it. Everyone's been very supportive and very in our corner. They know it can happen anywhere, and they're just happy to be here. They say it's a great town. We've done a great job.
Sure. And what did that one person, what did they say?
She wanted to let me know she packed 5 cases of water, but she hasn't had to use it yet, so she was pretty pleased.
Despite a study that estimates the economic hit to small businesses in Charleston around $61 million, local tourism professionals see the water crisis as a chance to reboot the local economy, like Bill Richardson, who operates Hatfield McCoy and Coal History Tours out of Logan County.
So it's natural. We don't want to focus on negative things. We want these people to come back and add to West Virginia's economy. This spill's already really hurt our economy, and we're trying to do something that's going to have an impact in a year. These people will all come back in next summer with these groups. So we're trying to focus on the positive things because we need this money to make up for all the money we lost because of the spill.
Richardson says he believes the timing of the water crisis in the off-peak winter season might have insulated the tourism economy to some degree. But the question remains as far as what, if any, long-term impression the incident might leave on those looking to travel to the area. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Dave Mistich in Charleston.
The 24th Annual International Water Tasting Competition took place last Saturday in Berkeley Springs, West Virginia, and a Canadian town, Clearbrook, British Columbia, walked away with the trophy for Best Municipal Tap Water. This year's panel of judges included West Virginia Public Broadcasting Executive Director Scott Finn, who lives in Charleston, where his family had to deal with the water crisis. This gave Finn a decidedly different viewpoint as he rated the water entered into the competition.
When I signed up to be a judge at the Berkeley Springs International Water Tasting, I thought it would be just a bit of fun. Then came the water crisis, a massive spill of the coal cleaning chemical MCHM into our water supply. My 7-year-old son, Max, came down with the stomach flu right in the middle of all this. We couldn't use the tap water, not to wash our hands or even our clothes. I'll spare you the details, but it was rough. So you can understand how the spill changed my outlook toward a water tasting competition. I learned to trust my sense of smell in more ways than one. A panel of mostly novices like me were to judge dozens of samples of tap water and bottled water, both sparkling and non-carbonated. We were trained by water master Arthur von Weisenberger, whose name so perfectly matches his job, I'm skeptical that his name is real. Good water, von Weisenberger told us, should have no odor. It may have a taste, based on the minerals, but it should not smell. Yeah, the smell. That black licorice smell. After the spill, it wasn't just coming from the water. It permeated the air of the entire Kanawha Valley. It was astringent. It hurt to breathe it too deeply. After state officials finally stopped the MCHM, after they told us to flush our pipes, you could still smell it in the water for weeks. I would engage in a nervous ritual, run the tap, lean in a little, and there it would be. So at the water tasting, when von Weisenberger told us to sniff the water 3 times to judge its odor, I knew exactly what to do. I soon realized that my sense of smell was one of the best indicators of whether I'd like the taste. I've never spent much time thinking about smells, but my son does. Max has autism, and he has trouble understanding the world through speech, so Max relies on his other senses, including smell. He has this habit of bringing all food and liquids to his nose and smelling it before deciding whether he'll eat or drink it. He acts like we're trying to poison him. But after the water crisis, I get it. Smell is what you depend upon when you don't trust anything else. It's our most primal sense. The other day at a grocery store in Charleston, they were selling a t-shirt with a picture of a man in a gas mask, emblazoned with the phrase, "Trust no one." Trust no one. That's the lasting damage of the spill in my community. We were failed by all of our institutions, the government, private industry, the water company. After the water tasting, I learned that Clearbrook, British Columbia, has the best tasting tap water in the world. In Santa Ana, California, it's tops in the U.S. And then I looked at the list of winners from the past, and there it was. Charleston, West Virginia, in the top 5 for best tasting tap water in 2 different years. Having the best water in the world is a proxy for so many other things: clean air, clean living, and a well-functioning, competent government. Maybe by following our sense of smell, my beautiful little city in the valley can find its way forward again.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Growers are being sought to participate in a 3-year research project to determine the viability of hop production in West Virginia. The project will be conducted by the West Virginia State University Extension Service. Extension agent Brad Cochran says in a news release that researchers want to determine the best variety of hops to grow in West Virginia. The goal is to foster commercial production of hops and to support the state's brewing industry. Up to 6 growers will be selected to participate in the project. They will collect data on the growing habits of hops. Applications must be submitted by March 20th. The Traveling 219 Project recently did a story about the history of Tigard Valley Homestead in Randolph County, West Virginia. The homestead communities of Daly, East Daly, and Valley Bend lie just south of Elkins on U.S. Route 219. Dan Schultz recently returned there to continue exploring the history and legacy of that ambitious government project from the 1930s.
The Farm Security Agency took over the homestead, originally a child of the Resettlement Administration, last fall.
This is Sonny Nags. He's reading from a newspaper clip his father saved from the late 1930s. Sonny grew up in Daly, West Virginia. Daly was originally part of the Tigard Valley Homestead, which was a New Deal project in the 1930s during the Great Depression. It was at this time that a new office, the Subsistence Homestead Division, was established as part of the Department of the Interior. The main goal of this Subsistence Homestead Division was to provide relief for unemployed families by building entirely new communities where they could live and work. In total, they built 99 of these communities around the country. Tigard Valley was just one of them. As kids growing up here in the 1950s, Sonny Nags and Lana Butcher were never aware that their community was historically unique.
My name is Lana Butcher, England. I grew up in the community of Daly, which is part of the homestead, and I lived right on 219. When I grew up, I don't know if it was any different for Sonny, but I didn't realize that there was any historical reference to our communities. We just knew the houses all looked alike and so forth, but we weren't taught the
history of it.
None of the history of the homestead, you know, the acquisition of the property and the building and everything, which we think now should have been, but it was not taught to us, you know, and everybody we were associated with were pretty well on the same level as far as money and everything else, so we were a very good community to grow up in.
Here in West Virginia, the Resettlement Community Project was meant to provide decent housing and a way of making a living for families from mining camps and logging towns. During the Great Depression, these communities were some of the hardest hit in the entire country. So in Tigard Valley, over 100 new homes and an entirely new community was built. By the end of the 1930s, a 550-acre cooperative farm had been purchased. A new modern-style elementary school building had been built, and a lumber mill was being opened to employ up to 150 local men. The dream was short-lived, however, and the Second World War ended the federal government's involvement in the resettlement experiment across the country. Today, it's difficult to find information on those early days of the communities that made up the Tigard Valley homestead, and besides the original buildings still scattered among the valley, little of the history is being preserved. Sonny and Lana are part of a small organization, the Tigard Valley Homestead Association, which is trying to change that. But the association only formed in the last 10 years, and gaining support in the area has been a slow process.
The association supports the homestead communities. We support Homestead School and some of the historic structures that are part of our history. We want to try to preserve as much of the history as we can. We haven't got our nonprofit status established yet, but we want to do that and see if we can get help, maybe acquiring one of the homestead homes as a museum. We've collected and had donated several items, furniture and written records, and we want to be able to share them with everyone.
Comparisons are often made to Arthurdale, the government New Deal homestead project in Preston County, West Virginia. At Arthurdale, they've been able to save and preserve many of its historic buildings, and they've also managed to open a historical museum.
In the beginning, Arthurdale Heritage, they own 7 buildings. Of course, they've been at this 20-some years. We have no property that we can use as a museum or anything else, and we started from scratch, and I think presently have about $7,000 that we have raised.
Much of the association's fundraising has focused on helping the old Homestead Elementary School. The school was completed in 1939 and still serves as the main elementary school for the communities in the area. But the school is being threatened by over $3 million in needed repairs and renovations. Both Sonny and Lana went to school there as children. Today, it's not only the school that's being threatened, but the history and the memory of the unique community that was built here to provide relief for families during the Great Depression. I asked Sonny about the possibility of acquiring one of the old homestead buildings for the association.
The buildings are all there, but they're privately owned. Everything's privately owned. So there's no community, there's no building where we can establish a library or a museum or anything else. And that's, I guess, that's part of our dilemma. Right now, we're just struggling organization trying to keep it going.
The story was produced by Dan Schultz of the Traveling 219 Project, a production of Allegheny Mountain Radio with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the West Virginia Humanities Council, and AmeriCorps Vista. To learn more, go to traveling219.com or Facebook. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.